Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sally Becker.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with the second part of Mark Dunley's interview with Mark Speedy, the co-chair of Troy Democratic Socialists of America. Then Elizabeth Press talks to Troy City Council candidates and community members at the Meet the Candidates Night, hosted by Troy Neighborhood Action Councils. Later on, Dulcinea Diggs talks with Ben Williams, executive director at Connect Center, a community hub for connection and empowerment. After that, Moses Nagel speaks to Andrea Miranda about her research on the history of Panama. And finally, we hear from Scott Kellogg, the educational director at Radix Ecological Sustainability Center, an urban development education nonprofit in Albany, about the upcoming Ruderal Ecologies 2 event happening at the sanctuary. But first, here are the headlines.
Albany County's district attorney, David Soares, called for cashless bail, but also increased discretion for courts to weigh a person's perceived dangerousness before releasing them, during an assembly committee hearing on gun violence Thursday. Advocates worry this will reinforce systematic injustices that they are trying to root out with their reforms. Soares said he believes that the community dynamics have changed because people feel threatened by people being released before their trial.
The Times Union reports that a coalition of public education stakeholders, which includes several Schenectady parents, signed an agreement with the state Wednesday to settle a seven-year lawsuit over unpaid foundation aids to schools in low-income and rural areas. The agreement is contingent on the state paying approximately $4.2 billion in owed school aid over 3 years.
It is now illegal in New York to threaten to report someone's immigration status. The new law classifies such threats as extortion or coercion.
If you want to vote by absentee ballot, you have until Monday, October 18th, to ask your Board of Elections to mail you one. After that, you will have to visit the Board of Elections in person. This year, absentee ballots must be postmarked by November 2nd and received at the Board of Elections by November 9th. Fear of COVID is now a reason that enables you to get an absentee ballot.
Federal government health advisors said that some Americans who received Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine at least 6 months ago should get a half-dose booster to rev up protection against the coronavirus. The booster shot is recommended for those over 65, as well as younger adults with other health problems, jobs, or living situations that put them at increased risk for COVID-19. That's it for headlines. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Like what you hear, find these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390.
In part one of this interview, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network's Mark Dunley talks with Mark Speedy, co-chair of Troy Democratic Socialists of America, about the overall political situations with the Democrats in the city of Troy, including issues such as Black Lives Matter, Sanctuary City, and the Troy Strong Party.
This is Mark Dunley. We're talking in our second segment today with Mark Speedy, who is co-chair of Troy DSA. In the first segment, we talked about the candidates that DSA is backing particularly the city of Troy, Marquita Edwards for city council, Kiana Conley Wilson, and D. Colin Charleston, and also DSA Troy. I mentioned they are supporting Alex Flood for county legislature from the Skodak district. In this segment, we want to get a little bit more into what's going on, you know, sort of politically in the city of Troy, and then hear what some of DSA's, you know, issue campaigns are about. So to quickly sort of set the background, you know, Troy is very interesting because it's perhaps the only real city in New York State where there's actually a both a competitive Democrat and a Republican Party in terms of elections in the city of Troy. Frankly, has resulted in a lot of shenanigans over the years and various political party operatives, you know, being sentenced for various, you know, election fraud activities. But it seems like in this election, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats have certainly fought at the city council level over things like designating Troy as a sanctuary for immigrants. But, you know, more recently, the push by some of the county legislators like Cindy Dorn and Peter Grimm to, you know, support the Black Lives Matter movement at the county legislature resulted in them basically being ostracized by the mainstream party. And so you had the Democrat, sort of the traditional conservative Democrats, you have the progressive wing, which, you know, certainly, you know, DSA would be part of, and you had the Working Families Party, you know, has been around for a while. And frankly, unfortunately, have been infiltrated on New York State election laws by the Republicans. And now the Democrats have, you know, created this Troy Strong Party somewhat as a more conservative, I guess, alternative to the Working Families Party. And so you have these a number of the Democratic candidates in various parties and various lines, in some cases having a three-way race. So that's sort of a complicated but very quick overview introduction. Where does Troy DSA sort of fit into, you know, how are you trying to shape the politics of the city of Troy, and how would you explain, you know, what's going on in the Democrats in the city of Troy, you know, to somebody you would talk to on the doors while campaigning?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the most important thing about Troy DSA is that we're a grassroots organization, right? We are a community, we are neighbors, we are people who are on the ground and volunteering for these candidates. You know, so we are trying to build that people power you know, talk to as many of our neighbors as possible, figure out what issues are actually important to them, and, you know, be able to, you know, formulate real policies that help people. And I think that the Democratic Party has been doing a lot of work to try and stay the same, to try and maintain their just slightly left of center viewpoints and policies. And I think that it takes a grassroots organization like this and grassroots campaigns like the ones we've endorsed to stand up for that, to, you know, remind the city council that it's that this is what the people actually want, you know, that when we work together, the issues that we actually want to support when we're paying attention are left of where they stand.
Now, it seems pretty clear that DSA and sort of the, if you say the main or the more traditional, older, you know, Democratic Party win in the city of Troy, which to me, you know, is behind the Troy Strong Party. You know, what are some of the key issues that, I don't know, people fracture over, disagree over?
I think Black Lives Matter is one of the big ones. You know, I think that people are scared of police reform because they don't understand it. And because that there's this weird sort of nationalism that surrounds the police force, right? There are some people who are very passionate about supporting our police department. And I think that our city council members are afraid of angering those people. Unfortunately, those people are not the ones who are actually impacted by police violence, generally speaking. It is the minorities, it is the working class, poor residents of Troy who are actually affected by it. And those are the people who we are trying to organize and get to turn out to vote, because, you know, they are the ones who are really affected by this.
Now, we've been talking about electoral politics, of which DSA has been, you know, quite successful, particularly in New York City in recent years. But you also are an activist organization. So clearly the Black Lives Matter movement, criminal justice reform is on your agenda. But what sort of like Detroit DSA, you know, issue campaigns that you're moving forward with?
Yeah, so there's a few. So first of all, we are proponents of the Defund Troy PD movement. So we have a website up, defundtroypd.org, with a petition that you can sign. Essentially, we really want to push our city to reallocate funds from our police department into other more useful aspects of our system. So that means, you know, social workers, mental health emergency responders that we've seen can be very effective in other cities, as well as, you know, restorative justice, nonviolent interventions, and things like that. We also have something on that same website called the People's Reporting Project. So you may be aware that the Troy Police Department has been very tight-fisted about releasing any of its disciplinary records and reports about police misconduct. Because we can no longer trust the Troy PD to police themselves, the People's Reporting Project is essentially a way for us to do that. It is an open forum where anyone can report a police misconduct that they have experienced or witnessed, that we can have a real record of, that we can use to either, you know, work with other organizations to form lawsuits, or just make public to, you know, call out the injustices that we have.
Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to turn to another one of the issue campaigns we have. If you want to talk about this more, we can. All right. So the one of the other issue campaigns that we're working on right now is for housing. So we've been working a lot with the Taylor 1 and 2 apartments tenants union, essentially making sure that they are represented in the decisions that those apartment buildings are going through. So there's been talk of Taylor apartments demolishing and building new buildings and things like that. We just want to make sure that those tenants are fairly represented, that they know their rights, and that they have the ability to collectively bargain and make sure they're not getting ripped off or evicted illegally or anything like that.
So we have a little bit over a minute left. I mean, one other big issue I know, and I assume DSA has been involved with this, has not only been immigrant rights, but also the relationship between the Rensselaer County Sheriff and the ICE. And basically, Rensselaer County was only, I guess, the only county in New York to accept this particular thing. Has that been something that DSA wants? And we'll also finish with this. And people want more information and get involved with DSA, how best do they do that?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. So we actually are supporting the cutting the ICE contract, the severe injustices that have been happening there. I don't know if some people might not be aware, but there was a migrant, an undocumented immigrant, who was detained by ICE and abused in jail for several days. There hasn't been any justice or talk of disciplinary actions for any of the people involved. So we are staging a protest coming up on Friday, October 15th. You can check out all the details for that on Facebook. The event is called Cut the ICE Contract, Free Them All. And we're working with a number of other organizations on that.
And Troy DSA, get a website, Facebook page?
Troy DSA, yeah, you can find us on Facebook, on all social media as Troy DSA. Our website is troydsa.org.
Mark Speedy, co-chair of Troy DSA, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
You can hear Mark Dunley's part one of Mark Dunley's interview with Mark Speedy on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
Since the Meet the Candidates event was canceled this year, Troy Neighborhood Action Council decided to host a candidate mingle for those who could still make the event. Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Elizabeth Press was there and spoke to the candidates in attendance and some community members about the upcoming elections.
That's nice. That's really nice. On Wednesday, October 13th, TNAC, or Troy Neighborhood Action Council, and the Troy Rehabilitation Improvement Project, or TRIP, hosted an opportunity for community members to mingle. This replaced their usual candidate forum that they usually host as an opportunity for community members to engage with candidates running for office. candidates in attendance were D. Colin Charleston from District 1, Keani Conley-Wilson from District 5, Marquita Edwards from District 6, and Stephen Figueroa from District 2. This is Marie Gavazzi from TNEC talking about why the event changed format.
Because there were a large number of candidates who weren't able to attend due to other events that got scheduled after this one was scheduled. And it was felt that it's important to provide information and education for people to make an informed choice at the polls. So instead, they're going to be doing short recordings with the candidates, visual recording. We didn't want people who didn't hear to be disappointed, and so that's why we're having the mingle tonight. And as you can see, there's a fair number of people who've come here and with other purposes, like meeting people from their own neighborhoods, as well as finding out how to learn about the candidates. And also, I'm going to be going around asking people to write down questions that they may have for the candidates that then could be used during the recording sessions.
Hi, my name's Shirley Buell. I'm co-president of the League of Women Voters of Rensselaer County. And we are encouraging everybody to look at early voting as an option. If you do early voting, there's three sites in the county. You may choose whichever one you want to. Atrium in downtown Troy, Brunswick, off Route 7, and Skodak for 9 and 20. This is a local election, and even though it doesn't get as much interest, it's actually so important for people to vote. There's a lot of money coming down from the federal government, and people you choose will be making decisions on where the money's used. So really, we want everyone to get out and vote. It starts the 23rd of October through the 31st. And then you can also vote on November 2nd, of course. So.
Excellent. And why did you show up here tonight?
I live in downtown Troy, so I was thinking there might be my representatives coming in.
Is that District 4?
Yes, it is.
Although no representatives from District 4 showed up, while I was talking with Shirley Buell, D. Colin Charleston from District 1 walked in.
I came to this event tonight, although it sort of changed in theme, because I think it's really important to meet the community that I will potentially represent. One of my favorite things during campaigning was meeting with candidates, knocking on doors and having conversations. And this is another opportunity to do just that. I'm running because I want to see some things change. And I talk a lot about change in, for folks who know me as a poet and an artist, I talk a lot about change in what I do. And this is another way to really implement the change that I'm already talking about. As far as the things I want to see change, I want to see abandoned homes and filled in, rehabilitated, taken care of. There's simple things that people have talked about that I feel will help them feel like the city's invested in how they live. And as far as other issues, I'm really big on young people and programming, prevention, and reform. We've had lots of conversations as a community about what reform looks like with policing and what does it look like to invest in community. I think all of those things are important. So yeah, I hope people will come out and they'll vote for me.
So Dee, you've been knocking on doors. What has your experience been on the streets?
One thing I've observed is that, you know, some people, when I knock on the door and I talk to them, they say that they don't actually know who their city council person is or who's representing their district and that they never met that person. And I don't think that politics should be that distant, you know, especially if we're making decisions that directly impact the lives of the people in our community. Our community members should know who we are and they should be able to have conversations with us. No matter what neighborhood they're living in. And how we get information out, I think, is really important. One-on-one conversations, small group meetings, maybe meetings that happen throughout the year where people can come and chat and they can get updates and share their concerns. That's really important. And when we have those kinds of meetings, especially in a neighborhood, getting the word out that it's happening so more people can attend and be aware of what's happening around them is really important.
Awesome. Thanks.
The night was warm, and as people mingled, I made my way through the candidates and met up with Stephen Figueroa from District 2.
I decided to show up because at the end of the day, I'm not running for me. I'm not running to gain power. It's all about the people. And I know that people are concerned, and I'm here to listen to what they have to say and how can we improve District 2. So, I decided to still come. There was a lot of residents that were still coming. And at the end of the day, it's about hearing them and being that voice for them. So it is very important that we still come here and listen to these concerns in District 2.
I know we have a fuller length interview coming out with you on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, but if you had to sort of summarize, what made you, what drove you to run for City Council Representative in District 2?
I mean, I think like any other candidate, you know, they want to see change, but most importantly is the safety of our neighborhoods. I want to definitely invest in the public safety in our neighborhoods, make our neighborhoods more safer by creating more resources and opportunities for programs for young people that I currently work on actively. We have great programs that's going on. We want to expand that. We definitely want to work on affordable housing and landlord accountability. There's a lot of building developers, a lot of people coming to our neighborhoods and doing, you know, what they want. And I think it's time that we set standards. If you're going to come and develop in Troy, if you're going to buy property, we have to set standards. We have to set policies and make sure that the landlords are being accountable so that we can keep these houses, these streets clean and things like that.
Excellent. Well, I'm not going to eat up too much more of your time so that you have time to mingle with people. But is there anything else that we should know here today?
Any residents, any of my constituents in North Central, I'm really an open book, open door policy. If there's anything that's concerned, I definitely want to hear it because I'm definitely want to see change in District 2.
So hi, I'm Amanda Tobias. I ran for Troy City Council in District 1 back in 2019. And my advice to people who are running for the first time, trying to unseat incumbents, is to get out and meet new people in the community. So there's a lot of voters who don't make it out to the polls. So give them something to go out to the polls for.
My name's Kiani Conley-Wilson, and I'm running for District 5 City Council in Troy. And I really decided to run because I wanted to see a lot of different changes happen in Troy. There are some neighborhoods that get a lot of attention, a lot of resources, and some neighborhoods like mine that tend to not get a lot of resources. And I wanted to make sure everyone could be able to enjoy Troy and, you know, have a good quality of life, which includes, you know, really nice housing and affordable housing that's dignified, having jobs that allow you to pay your bills. And then also I really care about sustainability, making sure that people have space to actually enjoy the environment and enjoy the outdoors and connect with the land. And then also just making sure that our leaders are accountable. So making sure we're making responsible decisions that are wise, monetarily, socially, all of that kind of stuff. So those are really the core values of why I'm running.
This has turned into a little bit different of a format outside the church here. Why did you decide to still show up, and why is it important to be out in the community?
You know, running for council means that you need to actually really engage and connect with your constituents in, you know, places where you may not always be at. And so I thought it was really important still to show up and make myself available to those who may have not heard that the Meet the Candidates portion of the event was canceled or just wanted to come out and talk. And I know earlier Marquita, Danielle, and I put out a statement really encouraging folks to come out, candidates to come out, because we really just want to connect with folks and make sure that their concerns can be heard, even if they may not, you know, have the means always to come to all these council meetings and all of that.
And Marquita, you're running for City Council in District 6.
Yes, that's correct. Right now we are running on sustainable housing, making sure that we've got also programs in place for our youth, and also that we are working to help build up small businesses and minority-owned businesses.
Cool.
Me being a community organizer, I felt that it was necessary for me to come out and meet some of my neighbors that I might not know already. Regardless, at the end of the day, of me being a candidate, I am a community organizer.
That last voice was from Marquita Edwards, City Council candidate for District 6. And we also heard the voices of D. Colin Charleston from District 1, Keani Connolly Wilson from District 5, Stephen Figueroa from District 2. And for more in-depth candidate profiles, you can hear Election Watch 2021, a series that you can find at sanctuarymedia.org. Early voting starts on October 23rd.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sally Becker.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. Connect Center is a community hub for connection and empowerment. Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Dulcinea Diggs interviews Ben Williams, the executive director of the center.
Hello, this is HM correspondent Dulcinea Diggs for WOC 105.3 FM. And today I am here with Ben Williams, the executive director of the Connect Center, which is located on 49 Johnston Avenue in Cohoes, New York. Please, tell us about yourself, Mr. Williams.
Hey, Dulce, how you doing?
I'm great.
Awesome. Well, I am the executive director of the Connect Center. I've been here for 4 years. Our mission is to break the cycle of poverty by connecting youth to their full potential. We do that in a number of ways. Probably first and foremost, we have STEAM programming. So STEAM is an acronym that stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, Arts, and Math. We have several spaces that we do our programming in. We have a full STEAM lab, which includes a music studio, tech room, a black box theater, and a media room.
Oh, wow. All right. So tell us, why is tech important for children to understand?
Glad you asked. Well, we can see from the recent pandemic that everything was heavily reliant on tech once we had to go remote. You know, that being said, I feel like that's only going to become more and more the case as we progress. Technology is evolving at a high rate, and these kids need to be ready for it once they step into the job market.
Definitely, definitely. Do you think learning skills from Google Meets and online classes are going to help the children in the near future?
Yes, to an extent. I believe there needs to be some hands-on activities too. So in our 5,000 square foot facility, we offer some remote opportunities and distancing for programming, which is great. We can spread out and kids can get hands-on experience with computers, with audio, with tech stuff, and in a safe environment.
Indeed, indeed. So what inspired you to make the Connect Center? I know you told me that your father found this place in 2012, and unfortunately he passed away in 2016. What made you want to keep it going?
It was such an amazing space and such an amazing vision. I had to continue the legacy. Our family is just, you know, we like to help people. We like to give back to the community. And in that same vein, I wanted to bring my skill sets to the Connect Center and help expand, especially in the area of technology.
Awesome. Now, I hear there's a music center here. Tell me, how did you start making beats?
I started making beats when I was at RPI, and a bunch of my friends from Collective Effort, who now own Collective Effort and started and founded it, they were in the electronic media and arts major, and I saw them making beats one day by banging on the table and sampling stuff, and I was like, I can do that. And 10 years later, here I am with a music studio and teaching kids how to make beats on their phone.
What programs do you use to teach children how to make beats on their phone?
We use a few programs. We teach iMachina, we teach FL Studio, the app, and GarageBand.
Wow. Now, FL Studio is that, if I might add, that is a very hard program to learn, don't you think?
I do think. That's why we break it down into steps. We also use YouTube University as a resource. We explore it together, to be honest. I don't know everything about these programs, but I know enough to get started, and we kind of explore them together. That's the fun of it.
Definitely. Now, what are the age ranges of children that can come here?
We serve students in middle and high school across the capital region. We are located in Cohoes on the 182 bus line, and we serve a lot of Cohoes students, but we are open to the entire capital region, and our programming is free.
Awesome. Now, when you see a child who isn't comprehending the material from the program, what is your next step?
Well, we run really small ratios. We like to have a 3 or 4 to 1 ratio between the instructor and the students. So that gives a lot of hands-on attention. So if a student is struggling with some of the material, we have the ability to go slower or to just change it up. Maybe it's not a good fit. Maybe they want to explore something else. It's really up to them. It's not a curriculum. We're not a school. We're a place for the kids to come and explore their interests.
Nice. Now, initially, how did the video game coding camp come into play?
Video game coding camp started, we started a relationship with Albany Can Code. They've been amazing to work with. It was a virtual camp. The kids learned several coding languages, and we are also doing a video coding workshop soon with Best Pass. It's just kind of the culture. The kids love the video games, and I love to teach them what's behind it as far as science, math, and technology, and then show them the future of it, you know, as far as careers go.
Awesome. Now, what are some major concepts you'd like your kids to take away from the Connect Center for Youth?
One of the big concepts that we were talking about earlier was entrepreneurship.
Yes.
So I want these kids to realize that the skills that they're developing here, they can take and not only go make money immediately, but also long term. They can build a career and, you know, be a successful member of society.
Now, you say your program is guided towards kids of middle school and high school children, but are they able to reach out to you after the program is over?
Of course. One of our first success stories was a boy, well, he's a man now, named Paul. He was having trouble graduating, and he approached my dad for some volunteer hours, and then he started doing odds and ends stuff around the building. And then eventually my dad got him hooked up with the local electrical union. Now he's making 6 figures a year. He just bought his first house. He's 27. I have 2 other students that I was mentoring that just joined the electrical union as well. I'm super happy for them. And I want to make more of these success stories. I really just want to connect the students to a career that they're passionate about and that they can make a good living in.
Definitely. And isn't that what it's about? Now, how did COVID-19 affect your organization? And what were some steps you took in order to restore normalcy?
COVID affected us a number of ways. It really amplified us in the community and put us in the spotlight as far as being able to serve the student populations. We were able to complete a lot of construction at that point. We got a lot of volunteer help, which was amazing. We were able to complete renovations of our music studio and Black Box Theater. And we were also able to create a socially distanced computer lab where kids could access and get homework help and work on resumes and, you know, just have a safe space to access the internet and get their work done.
Definitely. Now, what is one fact about video game coding that people may be surprised to know?
One fact is that, well, there's a couple facts that kind of blew my mind when I learned them. Entry-level video game coders make almost $100,000 a year.
Oh, my.
Yeah, oh, my is right.
You hear that, kids? $100,000.
Yeah. I was thinking about changing professions. And then the other thing that kind of blew my mind was how many languages there are, coding languages. We taught 2 over the summer, which are Python and the other one that I can't remember the name of. But those are the two super basic ones and a great introductory, you know, path to coding. But there's a ton of languages. So, you know, our coding classes can go on forever virtually.
Definitely. Now, I know this is a camp and a program, but like, do you think your kids will potentially get a job in video game coding with your program that you're offering here?
I would love it. I would love to be able to bridge that gap. Right now, it's very early, and really kind of exposure is the key thing. You know, getting them exposed to the coding and also feeling empowered behind it. I think those will give them confidence enough to maybe pursue a career in video games later.
Definitely, definitely. Now, how can the public reach you?
The public can reach me a few ways. First and foremost is email. My email address is ben@connectcenterforyouth.org. And also by phone, area code 518-687-1999.
Okay, and when is your next event?
Our next event is yet to be scheduled. We are in talks with a few different organizations about doing some more coding camps. I myself am going to host a few culinary camps. We have just come off the summer of our pretty intense programming. So we're kind of regrouping for the next few weeks and finishing up some building renos. But check the website at connectcenterforyouth.org. We have an events calendar on there, and we also have a mailing list that will alert you to our upcoming events.
Okay. Mr. Williams, do you have any final words?
Thank you so much for having me today. It's been a pleasure showing you around. I'm glad you caught the vision, and I look forward to talking with you in the future.
Yes. All right, folks. Well, this has been HM correspondent Dulcinea Diggs for WOC, and I spoke with Ben Williams, the executive director of the Connect Center. Be sure to go check them out. Thanks so much.
That was Dulcinea Diggs talking with Ben Williams, the executive director of the Connect Center. For more information, visit www.connectcenterforyouth.org.
Up next, Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Moses Nagel speaks with Andrea Miranda about her research on the history of Panama and her experience as an international student.
These decisions that I made to apply for a master's degree in University of Connecticut and then to this doctoral program are related to my history. I'm a historian, I'm a woman of color, I'm from Colombia, and especially I'm from the city Cartagena, which is a Caribbean city. And I decided to apply for the public university in Cartagena, which is Universidad de Cartagena, in 2005 to pursue my major in history. So I decided to do research on the political agency of popular sectors and indigenous communities, Afro-descendants communities in Colombia. And I had this amazing opportunity to work as a young scholar or a young researcher in an institute in Universidad de Cartagena. And that changed my life. This institute is International Institute of Caribbean Studies. After that, I decided to apply for a master's program in Panama. So I moved from Colombia to Panama, and that was in 2011. And I was exposed to this rich history of the Panama Canal Zone. So one of the things that caught my attention was that in the Panama Canal Zone was implemented these type of segregation policies in the 20th century, and these segregation policies were implemented by the U.S. government because the U.S. government got like a political control within Panama. Actually was created this Panama Canal Zone, which was restricted to Panamanian citizens. So when I was doing this kind of archival research in Panama, I asked myself, why don't apply to this master's program, the University of Connecticut, which is about the Latin American voices and Caribbean voices. Then I had this amazing opportunity to be a graduate assistant, and I did more research about race, about segregation, anti-blackness in Latin American countries. So as part of the program, I had to do like a Plan B paper, and that Plan B paper was about race, segregation in the Panama Canal Zone, but basically in the education system of the Panama Canal Zone. And I found that in the schools established in the Panama Canal Zone from 1904 till 1950s were implemented segregation policies. And the schools were divided into white schools and colored schools. White schools were mainly for U.S. American students. The other system was created for Afro-Caribbean students whose families were Afro-Caribbean workers who were hired to build the canal. I found that extremely interesting. And I was able to publish that small research on one book in Colombia, which was edited by Universidad Nacional de Colombia. So that was an amazing opportunity. But during that time, I knew that I just wanted to know more about the Panama Canal Zone, about the political context of Panama. Because of that, I decided to apply to LACS, because in LACS, I found a place not only to talk about history, but also to include other narratives as part of my research project. It's not only related to history, but also related to sociology, also related to cultural studies, which is something that is really fascinating, how to combine different research methods with my own interests. At the end, I decided to study more how the Cold War was happening in the Panamanian territory. So I found that during 1964, especially 1968, is going to take place a coup d'etat, which is going to be led by one military whose name was Omar Torrijos. And Omar Torrijos is a pivotal figure in the Panamanian history. He modernized a lot of institutions. He gave the opportunity to a lot of people to apply for the public university. He did a lot of changes, and Omar Torrijos is considered as a great leader in Panama. But also during that time, a lot of human rights violations were committed. And it's interesting to know why people, they definitely think that Omar Torrijos is a great leader, and why some other people, they just think that he's just one more dictator in Panama. But at the end of the day, he's a pivotal figure for the historical background of Panama. We cannot talk about Panama without talking about Omar Torrijos. And especially because he was one of the persons, and I don't want to say that he was the only person, but he was one of the leaders who made possible that the Panama Canal Zone and the Panama Canal basically was turned over to Panamanian citizens, to the Panamanian government. So that was possible because of the treaties signed between the U.S. government and the Panamanian government. And the two presidents who signed these treaties were Jimmy Carter and Omar Torrijos Herrera. So my question, or my research question, is basically how did Panamanian artists and media experience the Omar Torrijos dictatorship in Panama City? So at some extent, I would like to know if the art or if the music was used by the government, or probably was not used by the government, in order to legitimize this type of dictatorship. So I would like to know more about the role of artists, writers, photographers, filmmakers during this particular historical period in Panama. So that's one of my interests. The other thing that I would like to know is how was censorship and surveillance policies were enacted during Torrijos' administration, and especially if at the end these policies were imposed by the regime to silence the detractor voices. In another aspect that I would like to know is that basically is to comprehend whether Panamanian artists used the Torrijos regime to spread the revolution's ideals, or if they became fierce critics of the government. So that's part of my research.
Tell me a bit what life is like as you try to pursue this. I mean, I'm curious about how you think being an immigrant yourself affects your life in American academia, but yeah. also just in general, what how it is to try to balance all the different aspects of your life and teaching as well as you try to do important research like this.
Wow, that's an interesting question and a tough one, because one of the things that I have to say is that definitely my status, like an international student, like an Afro-Caribbean woman, a woman of color, that's my positionality. And at the end, that positionality got an influence on the way that I'm teaching, on the way that I'm understanding all these amazing material or amazing theories that I'm having access to. So at the end of the day, my positionality as an immigrant is going to have an impact on my teaching, is going to have an impact on my learning process too. For instance, coming from Latin America, in my case, it has been a process because, for instance, English is not my first language. English is my second language, and I'm always thinking Spanish. And the other thing is how to navigate on the academia when you are a bilingual person, for instance. That's an important thing that I have to recognize. But also I have to recognize that I had the privilege to be able to learn English in Colombia because my parents could only afford to pay an after school program, and especially my mom did that sacrifice. So at the end, I had so many privileges. My parents could pay for that, and I could learn English in Colombia. Then I moved to the U.S. and I realized that yes, it's a different story when you are in a classroom, when you are having these conversations with your classmates, when you have to read a lot of materials and a lot of books. For me, it was kind of difficult to deal with that at the beginning, but then I did a lot of effort to sharpen my language skills. So that's like an obstacle, but also that's a challenge for me. But definitely I have to say that it has been so, so fruitful to be part of LACS program because I have had access to different theories, to be in a classroom with students who are coming from different programs, not only LACS, but also they are coming from history, they are coming from anthropology, they are coming from sociology, and we're having these amazing conversations within the classrooms. And for me, that's so valuable.
The Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino and Latina Studies program at the University at Albany has many students, like Andrea Miranda, working on interesting and important research projects to improve the understanding of people who make up a large part of our population.
Next, we have Scott Kellogg, who is the Educational Director of RADx Ecological Sustainability Center in Albany. He will be one of the presenters at our upcoming event, Ruderal Ecologies 2, and Carolyn Tennant spoke with him about his work and the upcoming conference.
Hi, my name is Scott Kellogg. I am the Educational Director at the RADx Ecological Sustainability Center in Albany, New York.
Regarding the conference that's about to happen, the word ruderal refers to plant species that are the first to repopulate disturbed lands. Are the ways that you see your work working off this premise or adding to conversations about our environmental moment?
Absolutely. I use the term ruderal quite often to describe the consortium of plant species that I'll use as sort of a first step towards regenerating the health of, in my case, urban environments, degraded urban environments that are suffering from a range of issues, including soil compaction, poor soil health, soil contamination. Many of the so-called ruderal or disturbance-loving or rather disturbance-tolerant species that can thrive in these types of environments are necessary for really almost acting as a band-aid, you could think of it this way, on a wound. And in this case, the wound may be degraded soil health, but these ruderal species can go in and establish themselves and begin performing ecosystem services in environments where other plant species would not be able to. And some of those services include really just binding loose soil together, uncovered soil, soil with no ground cover whatsoever, that these plants can establish themselves in it, and by putting roots down in it, protect it against erosion from wind and water, which is one of the major threats to soil anywhere, but also in urban environments. They can also, by establishing the roots, begin building organic matter in the soil by beginning the process of creating symbiotic relationships with microorganisms in the ground, taking carbon dioxide out of the air, and in certain instances, nitrogen as well, and feeding that microbial community and literally putting the life back into it, growing deeper, which each passing year, and breaking apart hardpan and compacted soils and transforming the lifeless, the inorganic, into the living and the organic. It's also interesting that a lot of these species, these ruderal species, are often maligned. They're often considered weedy or invasive. And in certain circumstances, in certain locations, they could potentially pose a threat to native biodiversity. But it's often those same properties that make them weedy and invasive, which are, you know, anthropogenic, those are human terms, make them capable of surviving in degraded environments, and will, through successionary processes over time, be replaced by other species ultimately.
You know, you speak about the ideas around the term invasive, and I'm wondering if you could expand a bit about that in the context of looking at the, you know, the weediness of these materials that you're working with.
Sure. Weeds and weediness, that's purely a perception. That's just humans looking at particular plant species and deciding that they are undesirable for any number of reasons, whether they perceive them as posing a threat to cultivated crops that they would prefer to grow, or whether they genuinely pose a risk to native biodiversity, or in many instances, their objections are purely aesthetic, that they're simply plants growing in an unorderly way, and particularly in urban environments, which are based on the premise, the modernist premise of the idea of complete control of nature and nature's separation of nature and society. And plants growing in the wrong place are not tolerated. So a lot of times, weediness is in that regard, is a subjective quality. So invasiveness, though, is a tricky thing. Plants are deemed to be invasive if they are not considered native to a continent or a region, although you can sometimes have plants that are native to an area. Their native range may have been determined even less than 100 miles away, but can be considered invasive in a different area, even though they may have at one point historically have existed there. So the boundaries of where plants live changes over time. But when we're talking about invasive plants, I think it's really important that we do it through a critical lens that moves beyond this simple dualism, this simple binarianism of invasive, non-invasive. Plants also have their own means of dispersal. Some plants have arrived on the North American continent after 1492 by their own means of dispersal, whether that be through wind or by being transported by birds. So that's another thing to consider as well, that just because a plant may not be native to a continent doesn't necessarily mean that it poses an immediate risk to native biodiversity. We also need to consider what our prescriptions are for treatments of invasive plants. For instance, if we are using highly carcinogenic glycophosphate to, for instance, kill buckthorn trees, arguably the cure is worse than the disease itself. So we really need to look through it at a whole systems lens. Also being very conscious of a lot of the xenophobic and racist legacy that's behind the determination of what plants are considered invasive or not. There's a very interesting history attached to that as well, that depending on the land of origin of particular plant species, they may be more or less accepted accordingly to what the dominant culture's attitudes are towards that country of origin.
You recently published a book, Urban Ecosystem Justice Strategies for Equitable Sustainability and Ecological Literacy in the City. And I'm wondering how these examples play out in this book.
So in the book, I talk about how issues of equity and fairness, justice, race and class pertain to the biophysical dimensions of an urban ecosystem, such as its soils, its water, its air, its waste cycles, its non-human life, ultimately with the goal of developing a pedagogical model, a teaching method that emphasizes both the relevance and the centrality of urban ecosystems, particularly to urban youth, many of whom have ingrained negative attitudes towards the environments which they live in, often because of a dominant attitude within conventional environmental education that says, if you want to learn about pure nature, it's necessary to go outside of that city. We like to challenge that by showing that there is much that we can learn from the nature that is right around us, and by recentering issues of equity and fairness, of social sustainability, as we refer to it, we can show how it is more relevant to the lived experiences of urban residents. Again, because particularly in the fields of conservation biology, there's historically been a huge separation between people working for biodiversity conservation and for social justice issues. What we're really trying to do is show how those things are deeply and inherently interconnected with one another. So specifically, for instance, in the chapter in soil, we talk a lot about things similar to what we've been discussing already about the health of soils and how it's possible for humans to partner with biological allies, including plants and fungi and microorganisms, to go about doing the work of regenerating the health of damaged and degraded soils, particularly through an environmental justice lens. Looking at how it is that it's frequently low-income communities of color that suffer from a disproportionate burden of exposure to environmental toxicity, and how by using methods that are simple and safe and affordable, it's possible to take proactive measures towards addressing those persistent issues of toxic legacies.
Scott Kellogg will present his work on the last day of the Rural Ecologies 2 conference, which takes place October 22nd to October 24th. Visit mediasanctuary.org for more information and to register for the virtual event. That concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sally Becker.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, also your engineer. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meeting on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. You can find all the stories from today's program on our website through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.